The title of the talk has a kinship, has a connection with Christopher's group tomorrow, which is one of those kinds of connections that happen as we participate more and more together. The title of the talk this afternoon is Transcendent Culture, which can sound like an impossibility. One of the gifts that India has given me is the fineness of the language for talking about some of our spiritual experience. And so I often turn to my limited knowledge of Indian language to understand some parts of our experience. And so trying to think about the word culture, I remembered that in the Hindi, Sanskriti can be defined as refinement or refined. And then as I was checking with our Hindi translator and scholar and teacher here, Peter, if that was his understanding as well, I realized that I was not also diving into the potential or possible richness of the English word culture. And so I checked. And the word culture comes from the Latin, supposedly, cultus. So it sounds like cult, and it is related to cult. Cultivate, culture, culturing a bacteria, etc. But it's really beautiful. I even still feel a kind of lovely shockwave going through my being to know that what this root of the word culture and cult and cultivate, it contains, it's colere and tus or tus. So colere is to inhabit, to live somewhere, and to till or to work the earth, and to worship. This is what happens when we find that we are here. We are here, and we start to refine the way of being here by finding ways of working the ground where we are. And something transcendent calls our attention, asks us for humility, fills us with more than the food that we can grow. To inhabit, to till, to work, to plow the land, it's about the earth, and to worship are all inside that word. And, also shocking, the word culture is coming from a root, the last part, the tus, is about action. And this starts to show us how our actions are going into and helping to create the culture. How we are created and acted on by the culture, but also how we can, how we do, how our acts, the way we act, are not only just how I am here, how I live here, how I do my work, and how I love life. They're part of a kind of generational inheritance that I am receiving and passing on. So I'd like to talk about these three things that we do wherever we are: inhabiting, tilling, or working the ground where we are, working with the resources that are there, and this word worship. Trying to feel our way towards a possible transcendent culture, a culture that would help slide us towards a transcendent way of being and acting. One way that I think about culture is a gradual refinement of the way that we connect as a human being with other human beings and with the environment, with the resources that are available in that place. This is something that was much more noticeable here in India, because where I grew up in the United States, there's much less connection, there's much less of a feeling of what we're having for dinner has something to do with this place. There's a feeling that what we're having for dinner is what everybody everywhere always has for dinner. Whereas in India, there's still a sense of the seasons of different fruits and vegetables, and the how much better the mango tastes. Not only because it hasn't been shipped from Mexico, but also because it has been unavailable all year. It's not available in December. It starts to be available in April. There's too many of them in June. And we keep having our last one in the first couple weeks of July. And not only that, but then what happens as the refinement starts to happen, the love of of the resources that are available. So this is our life here and our life here. We start to love some of the resources that are available sometimes. So someone was telling me recently how many hundreds or thousands of varieties of mango there are, for example, in India. This is the kind of refinement that can happen as we interact with our environment. As we start to fall into meditation and we start to feel the difference between different fine differences of quietude or love, find differences in our experience of what we call the unknown. And as we taste them and then decide to plant some of those and take care of some of those, it becomes a new variety. So my action is enriching the mango culture or the meditation culture. So as we come to be here, in our spiritual practice, sometimes it's hard to know what are the resources that are available here. What do we have to work with? There are some things in common. Most of us seem to have a body. Everyone seems to be talking about their mind, and a lot of people talking about the heart, meaning all different kinds of things with the same word. And then there's the available resources that are just coming out of your own more personal history. And how to feel and find and bring out the richness of the resources that we start to know are here. How to bring out and refine the richness of what is called body, or what is called mind, or what is called heart. Without over-refining. So if we're growing canes for sugar, and we over-refine, or we're growing wheat to feed our families and the whole village, if we over-refine, we're actually taking out the food from the food and still calling it food. We're taking out all of the nourishment. And yet everyone seems to agree that it's food. So when we are disconnecting our meditation practice too much from what is here, what is actually here, so we may be denying that anger that keeps popping up. Or we may be too afraid to express that big love. we start to get into a little cage called meditation that is not nourishing. And if we eat too much of it, too early on especially, we will not grow. Our practice will weaken and probably start to die out. So if we start to notice that our love for meditation is feeling a little sick, we need to remember that we can feel what is nourishing, and we can grow what is nourishing, and we can harvest what is nourishing, and we can eat it, no matter what is being sold in the market. And as friends for each other, to help each other know from our own inside knowing, that's called food, but it isn't. If we notice that our meditation practice is taking over our life in the wrong way because of our ideas about meditation, it's blocking the love, the connection, the clarity, the seeing through, it would be like overusing some of our resources and not recognizing others. One thing that can be confusing as we start to really try to really actually connect and have direct contact with our life and with what is here, with this ground of our being, and what's actually native, what is actually a native form of life growing out of this ground of being. And especially these days with so many global factors, not to mention family factors and personal history factors. It's really hard to know what is native to this ground. What would grow here in a way that would enrich the place and feed many? What maybe used to grow here sometimes? Sometimes we need to look back some generations, which we can, when we come to India and we say, oh, it's so different. So different the relations between male and female, so different the kinds of houses, the kind of dirtiness. If we just look back a few generations, wherever we are from, it's not so different. And then we can start to be here, and when we're there, be there in a less judgmental way. In Spain, where my partner and I have a tiny piece of land in a big nature preserve on a holy mountain, which we've just come to be caretakers of in the last couple of years. We know that in the past, in this area, before potatoes came along, people ate chestnuts from the trees. So that means there were forests. There was shade, and there was a lot of water. What is visible now, if we would just arrive without that knowledge from a tradition, from our spiritual ancestors, or in this case, our agricultural ancestors, what we see is a lot of rock, some small trees, and a beautiful spring. But the connection between the spring, all of that fresh water, and the land has been broken in the last generations. So being informed by people who have gone before can help us see what connections have been broken where we are. And maybe it's too soon to plant chestnuts so far. Maybe we need to start with something else. Maybe it's too soon to say we could really fully live our deepest insight in every moment. Maybe we need to start somewhere else. We could say, I wish. I have a strong longing to live my deepest insight in every moment. And that would be coming here and starting here and growing from here. If we would just come to this piece of land, which we've given the name Dharma Loka, crazy Dharma and place of Dharma, double meaning. If we just come to Dharma Loka and say, what's growing here must be native. If I just start to pay attention to what's here, so if I'm just here and now, if I just pay attention to here and now, then I'll know what is a deep expression of the ground of being here. But what we actually see there are a lot of blackberries. Quite a few olive trees and hazelnut trees. And one huge oak tree that half of it is on our land and half of it is on the neighbor's land. The neighbor mentioned to the previous owner mentioned to us that the neighbor came some 10 or 20 years ago asking, wouldn't it be great to cut the tree down and have the money for the wood? And luckily, the previous owner said, are you crazy? Another friend who's a specialist in tree biology came, tree biology of this area of Europe, came, and she had to look at the tree for a long time to make sure she was identifying correctly a very rare species of oak. So sometimes we're not sure, well, is the oak, if I don't have the specialist knowledge, is the oak the thing? Or is the blackberries? There's a lot more blackberries going on here. So if we're trying to feel, what do I have to work with? What needs work? What is authentic? What could really be a genuine connection from what is possible into what is real? It's hard to know. And many times we might think we know what's happening and we give our attention to what we think is most important. And 10 years later we find out, good thing I didn't cut down that tree. So one example of that for me on the first retreat, the first long retreat I did, which was with Christopher and several other teachers in Bodh Gaya, which many of you have done just last month. And it was my first occasion of falling in love with that experience. I had had some experience with teachings before, but falling in love with that silence and stillness, hearing the teachings, all of the things that we know make up a retreat. But what was really deeply insightful for me on that retreat was actually what happened when I was eating my lunch. It's not that I didn't really love the silence, the stillness, the teachings, but what was really out of the blue, coming from the ground of being, for me at that time, was happening at lunchtime. I didn't know, because I was really in my inner space, not looking around at other people, no eye contact for 20 days. I didn't know that everyone went at lunchtime, everyone went at lunchtime into the nice sunny grass to have their lunch and get a little color on their face. And not sometimes not only the face. I was in on the cement floor in the shade with my metal plate, eating the lovely, made with love, rice and lentils and vegetables, chapati and salad. That very similar to what you would have eaten last month if you were there. And I wasn't only following the directions, which were, at that time, just observe what's happening. So I was feeling the texture in my mouth, in my throat, in my belly, the cold, damp cement under my butt. But I was also feeling, as I reflected on what made that food happen and how did it get here, and actually I'm putting that in my mouth, that stuff that came out of the earth, Indian earth, Bodh Gaya earth, in here, and I'm willingly doing this, and I'm chewing it up, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm swallowing it. Transcendent moments. I didn't know that people give guided meditations on this. But it's just a simple, natural human capacity to appreciate the vastness of a grain of rice. And all of those elements of the retreat that we recognize as retreat, silence and stillness and teachings and observation, did help me to have the space to eat that slowly and let my kind of, let's say, transcendent imagination have some room to play. Not a repetitive imagination, not something that I heard before, but something that I was not actually eating the dirt. I wasn't that far into the silence and the stillness. So I had an image of the dirt that had come into the rice, a felt image, you could say. And that could almost be called a kind of explosion of insight that made space that hasn't gone away in the being. So even if someone asked me, and people did ask, how was your retreat, I would never have mentioned lunch was by far the transformative time. Although people did mention that. Lunch was the highlight of the day. Especially compared to the supper of a sour orange and a glucose biscuit or whatever. It was something that felt so kind of private, almost embarrassing, that I would have to have really a trusting friendship to mention it. Another kind of experience that happened on the same retreat was that kind of experience. I mention it because it was very deep, and I did notice that I was having the experience, but it was somehow not recognizable until much later. It was an experience as if I were arriving at a lovely party. Someone was playing the guitar, and there were people who were just waiting for me to come, to start celebrating. That was the feeling. But again, so much in my own, the language of my inner being didn't match, excuse me. It wasn't being mentioned in the talk. In fact, as much as I still love to listen to Christopher talk, the only talk I remember was one that he gave, a really long joke, a really funny story. That's the talk I remember from the retreat. I don't remember what the meaning was. I remember laughing so much. So sometimes even an experience in meditation, in the hall, is so much in our own language, so much native to our ground, that maybe it's even lucky that we don't recognize it as an important experience, because then what we do to that, whoa. Instead of letting an experience quietly grow its roots in the earth and sprout and grow and eventually give shade and fruit or nuts. If we think we've had an experience, if we think we've had a transformative insight, what we do to ourselves. We might dig up the plant that we try to dig up the oak tree and put it all on our property and kill it. So sometimes the fact that we don't know how deeply we're being transformed by life and by teachings and by being together is a kind of protection against our fear of not having or being enough, making us grab onto the idea of and over-refine and take all of the nourishment out. So what if we guess that what we see happening, okay, we come to a new place, and we try to see what everybody does. We try to see what is the culture of this sangha. And we might try to fit in or we might try to go against it, depending on our personality. But is what's already going on native to us? Sometimes it is. We feel, and it's been said in this hall over the years, a sense of relief that I'm not the only one. Sense of, I finally found my spiritual family. But to be careful, because there might be something important about feeling the relief and still staying connected to the ground, still inhabiting our own experience, and letting our own experience, our individual experience, enrich what's already going on. So when we also see what's going on, and it seems to be greed and anger, judgment, exclusion, rejection, shame, etc. And we feel a strong pull to live differently. We might start enthusiastically on that huge patch of blackberries that's right in the middle of our land. And we might start out like without gloves and go back and get the gloves, bleeding. And then we might go and ask Jonathan if he'll come and help, which we do. And we both come with gloves. And it can be difficult to find a way to really uproot that painful way of being, that painful life form, that painful thing that's growing in our, where we are in our experience, even with help. And sometimes we find that by cutting it, we make it stronger. Sometimes we also find that by wherever we could clear that away, sometimes what's underneath is another olive tree, and we feel happy. And this is the case on our land. And apparently we have heard, but we haven't gone that far in the clearing. We've heard that underneath one big pile of blackberries is someone's abandoned car. A rusting white car. And it must have been there more than 35 years. It might not be white anymore. We did all that work to clear out the blackberries. We learned how to get the root. And what we find is not an olive tree, but somebody else's junk car. What do we do there? It's partly to encourage you when that happens, as a kind of calling towards even more creativity. Creativity in working with what are the available resources. Working with whatever is here, even if it couldn't really be called, it would be hard to call it culture. And as we start to work with what is here, we start to inhabit our experience enough that we start to learn how to work with what's here. We come to the tilling the land. I've heard some economists, anthropologists, and people who work with agriculture say that, excuse me, there's a connection between, excuse me, the amount of topsoil in a place, the amount of the actual living, so the living and giving earth, so how deep that is, directly shows the strength of the culture. And as the topsoil washes away, the culture is moving towards collapse and death, death of the culture. As we start to work in our gardens, we can start to notice what are we growing? What are we purposely growing here? As well as what are we discovering was already here? Sometimes we're practicing, we're trying to practice peace and we're practicing aggression. We're practicing judgment of someone who doesn't appear peaceful. And thereby leaving out any part of us that doesn't appear peaceful. We're practicing aggression. But there's also the joy of looking at what am I growing? What I planted last year and what I had the patience to wait. I didn't go and dig it up before it was time. And somehow I planted the seed, and somehow by itself, here it comes. And here comes 10 of them. And oh my goodness, 100 of them. So sometimes the first time gardening, we get the packet of seeds, and the seeds are so small. We plant all of the seeds in a little place. And when they 90% sprout, we're happy, and we realize we need more space. This is a way that the garden can start to take over our life in a nourishing way, in a beautiful way, in a green way. We could also look at this idea that to work with the land, to work with the ground of our being, means to dig. We could question if plowing, if actually cutting into the earth, is the best or only way of going deeply, of softening our ground. Are there any other ways of going deeply inside without using a hard, sharp metal tool. People who have more experience with gardening and questioning, just like people who have more experience, not just a few years with a few peak experiences, with spiritual practice and Dharma life. Their main advice is feed the soil. Don't try to feed the plant, feed the soil. And what does that mean in meditation? It can mean several different things. Could mean the more energy I put into thinking about what I'm doing, the less energy is going into actually doing it. The more I try to make the leaves green from above the earth, the more I'm probably blocking their natural function, the opening out of their true nature. So it is possible to feed a plant through the leaves. You can spray liquid food onto the leaves, and that can be helpful at a specific time. So the understanding, the information can really help at just the right moment. But if I feed the leaves too soon before the roots have really had the chance to do what they know how to do best, the roots already know how to go deeply. I'm putting the whole life force of the plant out of balance, and I might be killing it. When we try to grow love or clarity or peace in our garden, and we're very anxious to see that it is peaceful, that it is love, loving, we may give too much energy superficially and not enough patient energy that is without expectation and with trust. Trust in the life that was in the seed. That it knows what to do. So we're not actually inventing a plant. We're just planting the plant. When I'm trying to cultivate love in my life, I'm not inventing love. I'm slowly planting something that knows how to grow, that knows how to let life spread it up and spread it down and spread it wide. Trusting even with an actual plant, and even with an actual specific experience of body-mind. Within the plant, there is the life that gives life to that plant. And that life that gives life is what I'm trusting. That life that gives life, that lets the plant do its thing, that lets the mind learn how to do what really its thing is. If I notice in the mind something that's not native to the mind taking over, like ill will, negativity, there might be moments that I just need to go and cut it off. Because right now, it could hurt someone. A child is walking by. attracted to the blackberries right by the side of the path. So I might need to cut it off sometimes. But something that could be even more effective would be planting something that is so much a native of this place that it can start to take over even if there's a lot of blackberries. So if there's ill will, the Buddha suggested, cultivate love. If there's cruelty going on, cultivate compassion. And this is a recommendation for Jess's group tomorrow. The Buddha was speaking about the Brahmaviharas that she will be going into tomorrow. We may not be as effective as we deeply need to be if we try to go head to head with the blackberry. Whereas simply planting the plant that is more native, more vigorous, given a chance, naturally the blackberry starts to lose ground. And less do I need to do. So at the beginning of work, when we feel what is young in us, what is new, newly sprouting in us, let's say love in a field of blackberry, in a field of ill will. At the beginning, it is important, it is necessary, it's not just important, but necessary, to give that microclimate, the extra help, protection, shade, water, sun, whatever is needed for that plant, to get strong enough to take over. To let the ill will become unnecessary. To let the ill will die back and become earth again. We also need to stop overprotecting when the plant is big enough. We need to accept maturity when maturity has come. Too much watering, and it will endanger the plant again. So we may be practicing loving kindness that we heard in a guided meditation. And we try to adapt it and make it our own, and really give it time and give it energy. Make a space in the day that we practice it. Let it grow strong enough to be left on its own. And then we see how it starts to provide shade and nourishment. We see how the practice that I did starts to unveil. The work that I did starts to move towards a kind of love that feels totally different, almost unrecognizable. It feels as if it was already there. It's that native to the place. It's that much a part of our potential. So we start to know and work with our nature. And as we work creatively and wholesomely with our nature, we start to find that naturally we're getting pointed towards our true nature, something that transcends nature. It's not just working with. We may practice one-pointedness of attention. And we could feel how good that feels, the joy of when the plant starts to sprout. Wow, this really is possible. The mind actually can focus. It can seem like a miracle, the same way that it can seem like a miracle when the The plant actually comes up out of the earth by itself. By itself, with the help of the earth, the water, the sun. Without, and thanks to my not intervening and trying to pull it out, pull it up. We may practice focusing our attention one-pointedly and even feel some fruit from that. Some more lightness, some more joy, some less drama, some less heaviness. More willingness to let go of what is already dead and let it come back to the earth. Let it become nourishment. But we also need to then stop watering, stop attending to attention, and feel how the momentum of our practice can meet the true nature. So the nature of the mind is that we can train it. We can train it to be scattered, which is our training in our culture. And then we can purposely train it to be able to focus. It's the nature of the mind that it can be trained. It's the nature of that resource. We can work with it in those ways. But if we could let the momentum there from focusing the mind, meet something transcendent that is also here, also available. We can naturally then come to a one-pointedness with our sincerity, with our willingness to be wholly, completely, as much as we can with what we know is important no matter what. So at the beginning, taking care, the Buddha tells a story, or there's a story told about the Buddha, where a group of young students came to where the Buddha was to hear his teachings. And they were incredibly noisy. And the Buddha asked, "Who are these people? What are they doing here? They're not coming in the spirit of Dharma. They're coming without mindfulness. They're coming without respect for the other's silence, etc." And the Buddha's own closer students had to convince him to give the teachings to these new noisy students. And the images that were used to convince the Buddha to have some more patience were, when a new plant is trying to grow, if some irregularity happens, if the needs are not met in the beginning, there's likely to be a lifelong problem. If a baby cow has some irregularity in the way it's taken care of, if it's not taken care of at the beginning, there can be a lifelong problem. There's some needs in our spiritual practice that are not taken care of. We may go a long way off of what is true for us. And if we give full attention to what is important, for the, what is young in us, it gives a kind of protection that then lasts by itself through the life. We don't have to keep giving that attention. And that momentum and that protection and that care can keep resonating even as we go through cycles where it seems like nothing's happening and we're just letting the ground rest. We're letting the ground recover, which it often can do by itself. And the times where there's clearly more fruit coming. So extra care at the beginning. For some of us, the time with either the retreats in Bodh Gaya or in Tiru, and then here in Sarnath together, have brought to life something that is still young in us, even if we have been practicing meditation for 20 years. I feel in myself something just sprouting this week. It's so easy to feel that this kind of support is going to be there on the 20th of February, no matter where I go. It feels so natural. It feels so right. And it has happened year after year that some people really let that momentum, that energy that's gathering together through the silent retreats and then the time here together, have let that help them fly. The danger of not valuing the support that's here and the support that might be needed is that this could just become a high that we look back on as a high. The possibility is that it's just the starting place that we move from. And so in many ways, in each of us, we could be aware of what in us is young and needs protection, and what in us is mature. What has already grown up enough to become a source? So in the south of India, there is an ashram that is working towards becoming a city of Dharma. It's called Auroville, it's Village of Dawn. When people first went there several decades ago, there was here and there a scraggly tree, a tree that was really respectable for being able to be alive there. And you could see from kilometers away, you could see the sea across just the what was a wasteland, which now is a forest. It's only a few decades later that Auroville now provides firewood to the villages that are included in it. Whereas before, women walked 4 miles to get fuel and then carried it on their heads. It's the kind of difference that we can make outside and inside for ourselves and for others. So the danger of protecting too long is that we don't let our richness be tapped into. We don't let our trees be ready to be firewood, because there is enough. We don't have the idea that we should be firewood now and cut down whatever tree managed to survive the French and British deforestation. But we humbly let our forest where there's forest give the abundance that it is. So as we're looking at what we are growing and what we could grow, let's remember the trees. Let's not only grow the food we need for this season. Let's remember the trees that know how to pull nourishment from above into below, and from below into above. Someone said the true meaning of life is to plant a tree under whose shade you do not intend to sit. This would be a beautiful gesture in the outer world. I think we rarely feel how we are planting trees inwardly. So as we feel our life inhabiting our experience and working with the resources that are available, after a while, after we keep working and working, and we start to notice that really what's joyful is not so much the work as just being in the garden when I'm not working and seeing the light in the leaves or in the face of the flower. And so there's this word worship that is part of the idea of culture. The importance of honoring what is unworked and unworkable. It's raw and pure, like honey. So as we came to inhabit our experience, and as we came to work with our resources, learning to bring out the richness in what is here. The importance of leaving room in our work with the limited, leaving room for the limitless. As we work with what is born and dies, leaving room in every second, every step of the way for the deathless. Humble as the earth, connecting to the deathless in any experience that is born and dies, that comes and goes. Letting what we practice, so we practice that gathering of attention, letting that fall into an unhesitating gift of everything we have and everything we are. That act, that offering that we could call worship. Letting what we worked unveil what is unworkable, what is effortless, what we could say was here before here arrives. And as we work with things, we get a sense of, as with the rice on my plate in Bodh Gaya in 1988. As we work with what we find in our experience, we start to see what a vast kind of network is going on in each taste, in each mouthful. And many times this kind of interconnectedness is considered to be a difficulty. A vulnerability. We are vulnerable to not only our own influence. We are vulnerable not only to the influence of our wisdom within ourselves, but with the one-pointedness, with our own sincere giving to what we know is the only tiny place that's trustworthy in all of this that comes and goes, is not trustworthy. We leave room for the way that our vulnerability and our connectedness allows transcendence, allows the interconnections to work not only in a downward spiral where we just keep repeating the past. So we're not only imprisoned with cultural pressure, fully inhabiting, like showing up, letting the limitless work on us. From a place of already having it all. Here it is. Vastness in the grain of rice. It gives us a sense of how powerful a tiny action might be. It almost gives a sense of the more subtle the gesture, the more potentially enlightening. Can get in touch with that light that shines, as in the Gayatri Mantra, not only on the earth, but under the earth and above, in space. That light, like the honey, raw and pure. Letting that taste come through in even a single gesture. There's a chance that it could just lift up a whole society. Because it's even more native than what is the native plant, even closer to home. May all beings participate in transcendent interconnectedness. May our deep hearts be the ground we inhabit. Work with and make offerings to. May our gathering be a momentum of and for liberation everywhere.